Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with different topics, two different topics every day. And if you'd like to look at the schedule, listen to past programs, sign up for podcasts, or get more information about programming on WILL radio and TV, go to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. In June, parts of the Midwest experienced flooding at levels not seen since the Great Flood of 1993. Parts of seven states were affected, including Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, and Wisconsin. Iowa was particularly hard hit, with cities of Iowa City and Cedar Rapids experiencing very significant flooding. Question is, was this just bad luck, the result of very heavy spring rains, or have changes to the landscape increased the chances for this kind of destructive event? And this is something that we can prepare for, be better prepared for, or is it something that periodically it's just going to happen? We'll try to take up some of these questions this morning as we talk with Gerald Galloway. He's professor of engineering in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland at College Park. He's also an affiliate professor in the School of Public Policy there. His focus is on water resources policy and management. He's also a visiting scholar at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Institute for Water Resources. He has quite a lot of experience dealing with water management issues, both in the U.S. and internationally. He served as a consultant to the Executive Office of the President, has assisted the U.S. Water Resources Council, the World Bank, the Organization of American States, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Corps of Engineers, and the governments of several states. From December 93 to July 94, he was assigned to the White House to lead the Interagency Floodplain Management Review Committee. This was involved in assessing the causes of the big flood in 1993 and proposing some approaches to floodplain management. And we'll talk about that this morning in this part of the show. Questions from people who are listening, certainly welcome. The number is 333-9455. Now, that's the one for just Champaign-Urbana here where we are, but we do also have a toll-free line. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the internet, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, and the call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, if you've got questions, comments, give us a call. Join in the conversation. Professor Galloway, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a privilege.
Just to start with the question there that I raised in my brief introduction, I think that some people probably would say they'd say, look, this spring we had an awful lot of precipitation over the areas that we're talking about. We had soils that were saturated with water. And then on top of that, we got, in a relatively short period of time, and a much greater than average rainfall. And that was the result here, and that some people would say, well, you know, yeah, we don't like these things to happen. There was a lot of destruction of property. Some people actually were killed. But they would say that what this is bad luck. It's going to happen, and it's not the kind of thing that you can prepare for. I expect that you would disagree with that.
Well, I certainly would agree that with almost every statement that you made in the introduction, except that you can't prepare for it.
Right.
It's really a shared responsibility for everyone to deal with these unusual extreme floods, but not ones that we haven't seen in the past and are certainly going to see again. It's interesting, when we gave our report to the president in 1994, we said the Midwest flood was a significant hydrometeorological event. He said, what does that mean? We said it rained a lot. And that's the problem. And you put your finger on it. When you have what we call antecedent conditions, where the rain goes on for several weeks or months, as the case of 93, and soaks the ground, when the big gully washer comes, most of that water is going to run off and go right into the rivers and create the flashiness that you saw a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that at the same time, though, that you would say, and I'm sure other people would say, you know, having come through that experience of 93 and then not all that long having come through the experience of Katrina, that we should have learned some things from that and that there were lessons to be taken away. And that while people might have talked about the fact that there were a number of things that we can do to look at the floodplain and some of the things that we have set up, the levees that we've set up and so forth, that to deal with these kinds of things, that we can look at that, we can make improvements. But I'm sure that some people would say, you know, we talked about that, but we didn't do anything about it.
You're absolutely right. The most critical part for anybody that lives or thinks they live near a floodplain is to be aware of your surroundings and understand where you live and what your responsibilities are. To understand if you're being protected by a levee, who's in charge of it, what level of protection does it provide, and knowing full well that there's no such thing as absolute protection. And then that says, do I know how to get out of here? Have I taken the things that are most valuable to me and stored them on the second floor? Have I worked a way to try and keep the water out of the more critical areas in my house? People have moved some of their electrical systems up to the second floor. All sorts of things that you can think about. But that says if you're aware that you're in the floodplain, then you perhaps ought to take these steps. If you're not in the floodplain and are considering moving in, you ought to figure out what could happen to you. And are you prepared to take the catastrophic loss that might occur when the big one comes along? Mm.
Well, I wonder how much risk for people who do voluntarily decide that they're going to live in a place that's flood prone, how much risk they're taking on, and whether, in fact, I'm sure that you could probably find people who'd said, well, I'd lived here for a long time, and in just until recently, we didn't have any problems. Is that just being short-sighted, or is somehow the level of risk associated with living in a flood-prone area is on the increase?
Well, no, yes and no. Start off with, if you say that, I've never seen one, I've been here for a long while, you really don't understand probability, better not go to Las Vegas, because there are odds out there that it's going to come back. And it can be, and we've seen this, unfortunately, that you can have very large floods that we thought would occur on the average once every 100 years. You can have 3 years in a row or 3 in 10 years, anything like that. So there's the first issue is you've got to understand that the probability is in play. The next thing is you need to understand that if you're in this area, again, you need to understand what could happen and then what are you going to do about it. And I think that most people, I'm afraid, don't understand where they are and what that really means. The toughest job that the federal, state, and local governments have is communicating the risk that exists.
And I think you point out to something that I think is true, that in connection with this last flood, people talk about this being a 500-year event, or perhaps the one that we had in 93, people talked about that perhaps being a 100-year event. And people seem to have gotten the idea in their head that, well, what that means is that's only going to happen once every 500 years. Now, that's really not what that means at all. Maybe it means that the odds of it happening are low, but that also doesn't mean that you couldn't have it happen 2 years in a row.
Yeah, you could roll the dice and come out with the wrong roll 3 times in a row, unfortunately, and that's what's happening. And that's the challenge, is to understand that we are learning a lot. And you ask the question of, well, is it any different? I'm not speaking for or against climate change. I think that climate variability or change exists and that we're seeing differences in what it's been in the past. And you just had a couple of weeks ago Tom Carl from NOAA speak at the White House and say, we are going to expect an increase in heavy rainfalls, and we've already begun to see them. We've seen that. You all recall the great flood on the Red River of the North up through Grand Forks, North Dakota in 97. Again, a massive rainfall event. You look at the rainfalls we've had here recently, and each one of them, they're not geographically isolated, they're scattered around the country, has been intense rainfall over a short period of time. That's just what the climate change people have been predicting is going to happen.
Let me just quickly introduce our guest once again, Gerald Galloway. He's professor of engineering at the University of Maryland at College Park. His focus in his academic work and research is water resources policy and management. We're talking about some of the flooding that we saw earlier this year in the Midwest and what we should be doing to try to respond better. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think also that some people have argued that some of the things that we have done in terms of modification of the landscape, particularly maybe over the last, say, 150 years, has also increased the likelihood of flooding. We've lost wetlands. We may, through erosion, be adding to silt levels in the bodies of water that exist. We have reduced the natural ability of the land to absorb water so that when we do get very heavy, unusually heavy rainfall events, it really doesn't have any place to go.
You're right there in the sense that certainly in the more frequent floods, the ones that you see that have a return interval or the idea that they occur several times in a 10-year period, when you have taken away the wetlands, you've taken away natural storage that exists. When you've levied off areas, you've taken away natural storage. On the other hand, when you get to the kind of floods that we just had, the 500-year or a very large, I don't like that term 500 because I don't think we know that, but a very large flood, then and it's rained beforehand, then there's really no place for the water to go. If you had wetlands, the prairie potholes would have filled up. And we ran some studies after the 93 flood, then again after the 97 flood, and I was just part of an effort in New Hampshire where they looked at what would have happened if you'd had more storage. And the answer is it would have taken an inch or two off, but it wouldn't have changed the fundamentals of the flood. When you have these major events, the kind of the 93 and now the 2008 flood event, the actions you've taken are not going to make as much difference. They make a big difference. Losing those wetlands when you have that afternoon gully washer, it hadn't been raining for several weeks, you lose that storage, and certainly it's going to make a difference downstream. But when you're talking about these major events, what we've done is not going to make that big a difference. It's interesting. We've gone back in history and looked at the poor people in New Orleans sit at the bottom of this funnel that drains 41% of the United States, where you are out to the west and further to the east. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear that the changes in land use sent sediment downstream, did other things change the fundamental nature of the river. But when you go back in deep history, you can discover that many, many giant floods occurred in the past, even before we settled the land. So that's not to say we ought not to guard and deal with this issue of landscape modification. On the other hand, it says it's not the total answer to the problem.
Let's talk about the levee situation, because here I just have in front of me a piece that you wrote not very long ago. It was published in the Washington Post about this particular problem about our failing to take action. And right here, you write, levees are the heart of the problem. And essentially, and to make sure what people know what we're talking about here is it's an earthen kind of embankment that's constructed on the side of a river, of a stream, of a waterway. And the idea is that as the water rises, it's going to hold it in so that it doesn't end up spilling over the banks of the river or the stream and flooding the adjacent lands. What's the problem we have with that defensive system, that thing that's really the first line of defense we have against flooding?
Well, that first line of defense is older than our country. Back in 1717, Bienville, when he moved to New Orleans, started building small levees to keep the periodic rises out of the city. And what's happened over time in Iowa, Illinois, everywhere up and down major rivers in this country, people started with small levees, put more people behind it, tried to protect them, and continued to raise levees. The problem is now, and in the Midwest especially, we have a really loose mix of all kinds of levees, some done by the federal government, some done by local governments, and some done by individual farmers, where they've pushed this earth up, in some cases have done it very well, compacted it, and gone according to specifications. And I can tell you, for example, that the levees on the lower Mississippi, which run from Cairo down to the Gulf of Mexico, haven't been overtopped, haven't failed, haven't had major problems since 1927 when that big flood occurred, because they're carefully engineered and carefully watched. In the Midwest, we had the problem of all sorts of levees, not coordinated, not integrated, and not well-maintained or even inspected. The other part is you build it so high, and let's say that you build your levee 10 feet high, you're going to keep water out till it gets to be 10 feet high. After the water gets to be 11 feet, it's going to be in the city or in the field, and it's going to flood you. Why did you pick 10 or 11 feet? Some people have got no idea, and the sad part is many of their neighbors who live behind that levee said, well, I thought there was a levee there. That's going to protect me against everything. Well, that's probably the most difficult thing to understand. If you're behind a levee, you don't have absolute protection. You may have very little protection, as a matter of fact. So when I said before people need to be aware, it's to understand what's that levee out in front of me going to do, who made it, and are they really taking care of it? And that's the other part of the equation. We don't know in the United States where all our levees are. We absolutely have levees out there that people have never put their finger on from the state or local governments or the federal government and said, this is this kind of a levee, and it's got this height, and it's going to do this for these people. We after Katrina, got the Congress started on this, but they haven't appropriated money for the Corps to go out and find these. And once they find them, somebody's got to say this levee is in danger of falling apart. And we've seen that happen. Now, fortunately, in the Midwest case that we just had, most of the levees did not fail. In other words, as the water was coming up, suddenly the levee began to crumble and fell away. The levee did what it was supposed to do to the right height and then overtopped, and the water rushed in behind, and then it may have come apart because of that rushing water on the inside of it. But all that's to say that the people that live behind it, or the people that built it, had a standard that was lower than what nature brought about. I think you could see that in Cedar Rapids.
Uh-huh. Well, is then the solution building your levee higher, or is it that you need to have this, you need to have a more complex sort of system of water management so that if the water, if you have a 10-foot levee and the water gets to 11 feet, that you have some other way of dealing with that excess water?
Exactly. You've got your finger on the answer. What you have to do is look at levee as one part of a flood risk reduction effort. In large metropolitan areas, and that's what you have in places like St. Louis and Kansas City, and you have higher levees, stronger levees, because there's more at risk. The catastrophic loss of that particular property behind the levee would be so large, so you invest more in making it higher. Agricultural levees were designed to let people farm most of the time and to recognize that periodically they may overtop. That means, though, that the farm houses and accessory structures need to be protected and need to be provided some ability to withstand one of those floods. And some people, I know people who call themselves river rats, love to live along the side of the river. And most of them don't live on the first floor. They use that for storage and for garage or just putting something as a way for the water to go through, and then they stay out of the water's way. I think that's the challenge, is understanding what's going to happen when the water gets over the top of your levee. You can't build everybody's levee to the top of the sky. You can't build anybody's levee to the top of the sky.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Gerald Galloway. He was an engineer, professor of engineering at University of Maryland, College Park. His interest is water resources policy and management. We're talking about the flooding that happened in June in the Midwest. A number of states affected, including Illinois, also Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, Wisconsin. Big time flooding, of course, happened in Iowa, in places like Iowa City and Cedar Rapids. We're talking about what happened and why and how we can be better prepared for this kind of event in the future. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. And we also do have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Just I'm interested in having you go back to the subject of levy assessment cataloging, that we don't really know quite all where they are, what kind of condition they are, whose responsibility they are. In after Katrina, I'm sure this was prompted by Katrina, the Bush administration did indeed ask for some money, and some money was allocated to start this. But one of the things that you note in this piece I mentioned in the Washington Post was that initially some money was provided, but there was no money was put into this last year, no money this year. So the program, I guess, has come to a halt. Where does that stand? And is there anybody, is the administration or anybody in the Congress saying, wait a minute, this was a good idea, this was important that we start this and carry this through, and it's short-sighted that now at this point we're not putting any money into it?
Well, I certainly think that the administration is well aware after the Iowa floods, the president visiting the area himself, and there's been some discussion, anything in the Washington Post generates some discussion, that we really ought to do something about it pretty quickly. And so the Corps is anticipating, I believe, that they're going to get some money for this and be able to continue it. It's tied into a joint effort with the FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to identify levees, because levees are also part of the National Flood Insurance Program. And that's an issue. FEMA need to know, are the levees that they say they give a community credit for having to protect their people, are those levees in good shape? So the Corps and FEMA are working hand in glove to look at this. And that raises a question, if I just might jump in with this idea of insurance. Mm-hmm. One of the things that everybody that lives in the floodplain ought to do is buy insurance. There's actually legislation pending before the Senate right now, or actually it's been passed by the Senate, it's in conference, that would require anybody that lived behind a levee to buy flood insurance. Just because there's a recognition then that there's a risk to living behind a levee. And if I lived in the floodplain, or I lived in an area where you see overland flow, when you get too much in the drainage ditches and you're in a flat land, you may not even be near the river, you've seen the water up over the road, I might consider getting low-cost flood insurance, because it is something where you can share in the responsibility, but you can also protect yourself against that eventuality.
All right. Let's talk with the caller here. We have someone in Champaign on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, a couple of points. One is that while traveling along after the 93 flood in Missouri, Illinois, and Iowa, I noticed that really what's going on is a kind of levee war where each state accuses the state across the river of raising their levees, and therefore that the origin state has to raise their levees. And it's something the Corps of Engineers just loves, because they can be called in to raise the levees on the other side, the low side of the river, and they'll raise them, of course, a little higher than the ones across the river, and then the levee wars start again after the next flood. That's one observation that I made. The second thing is that what people, it seems to me, need is a kind of a very simple guide when they're considering moving into the floodplain. And one of those is that the land cost in the floodplain will be much lower than the land costs of the same size, say per acre, in the nearby upland. And that seems to me to be the biggest clue to the fact that the flooding is going to occur and cause damage to you if you build it in the floodplain. I don't know whether that's really a good indicator or not, but it seems like a simple one.
I would certainly agree with you. In the latter case, having a guide, after the 93 flood, we recommended some insurance reforms, and one of those now has forced anybody that buys a home and gets a mortgage has to get a stamp from somebody that goes out and identifies whether or not you're in the floodplain. And if you see something that's very flat and you see that the land costs are low, you ought to know right away that you're in a floodplain. And, of course, this certificate will tell you, give you that information.
Right.
As to the levee war, though, that's a little an interesting question, because I don't know of any case in quite some time where levees have been built higher, federal levees have been built higher on one side than the other. It does happen that individual levee districts can build their levees and add a little bit to it. As a matter of fact, that was the source of a lawsuit between the state of North Dakota and Minnesota that went to court, and they worked out that you couldn't do this without having both sides agree on it. Interestingly enough, during the 93 flood on the Missouri River, a community was going to sandbag, and they started putting the sandbags, and the state police came up and said, you can't do that. You signed an agreement that you wouldn't sandbag, because you will then cause flooding on the other side.
Interesting.
This is a tough issue. I mean, I don't think anybody that put sandbags up this year intended to do harm to anybody else. But very clearly, the minute you try and raise your levee, you're going to change conditions upstream or downstream. And what we've argued is you need to take a holistic watershed approach when you do these sorts of things. So you're absolutely right. You don't want to see these wars. And in after the 93 flood, Missouri and Illinois almost signed a treaty that would have said we're not going to do anything to each other, but it fell apart in one of the legislatures.
That's right. I was standing on the levee blowout at St. Charles, Missouri, and the emergency county people standing there shaking their finger at Illinois because Illinois had higher levees.
Yeah, I mean, that's and if you don't have them in actuality, you certainly believe it if you're going underwater.
Yes, and she was also making the announcement that the Corps had just approved, or that Congress had just approved for the Corps to build these levees to the 500-year level around St. Charles.
Well,
there were jets turned upside down on the St. Charles airport in the 93 flood. They floated and flipped over and landed on their top as the flood went down. It was just a massive set of flooding out there.
Well, I testified last week before the Congress about that very issue in that area. The Corps of Engineers asked for money to do a study, so they could see that if you built a levee in St. Charles and one on the other side of the river and here, what would be the cumulative impact of those? Because what's been happening is Congress will approve one project without really understanding what impact that's going to have on everybody else. And the Corps is telling them that that's not the right way to go.
Well, again, I guess we come back to this idea that if this is our first line of defense, if the levee system is the first line of defense, then we have a problem here if we have this very tangled and complex and sometimes uncertain system of jurisdictions, and we don't know who's responsible for what, and there's nothing in the way of a uniform standard. It sounds as if there should be some entity that has overall responsibility, and maybe that should be the federal government. I don't know, but that's the case. It seems to be that, in a sense, nobody is in charge.
You're absolutely right, and that's what we said to the president in 1994. That's what we said after Katrina, that when you don't have anybody in charge, nobody's in charge. And if you don't have it very clear, what happens is everybody does what they want to do. And I would argue that it begins at the local level, the people that approve levees in their communities. The interesting part is you can, in most places, you need some sort of a permit to build a house, but you don't need a permit in most places to build a levee. And that's the amazing part to me. So it's got to start at the state and local level, and then the federal government can certainly be part of that by helping coordinate and deal with this issue of planning on a watershed or a basin level approach.
All right, let's talk with someone else. I want to thank the last caller. The next caller is also in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Yes, I've been listening to this, and I guess I'm going to take a draconian approach to this. I'm very cynical. If we're going to get any risk management here and avoid this happening again, I'm cynical with the White House, the Congress, and most importantly, the Corps of Engineers and FEMA. I think the record of all these entities is pretty bad, especially the Corps and now recently FEMA. So I'm thinking that I just don't think we have the mechanisms in place to deal effectively with risk management for those who live adjacent to the mighty Mississippi or the Missouri or whatever river could escape its banks. I was thinking that maybe we ought to take a land management or a land planning scheme that deprive people from building in floodplains close to these rivers, and secondly, create therefore a buffer and sort of take that form of risk management, because otherwise we're going to have a situation where people without flood insurance, as we have now, do not internalize the cost of their adventuresome nature. And that cost is spread among the various taxpayers, including a tax-strapped person like me. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think you've got something to say. I'm not sure I would pick on FEMA and the Corps for this. All land planning by the Constitution rests at the state and local level. Since 1968, when the flood insurance program came in, The federal government has said to the local communities, look, we'll allow insurance to be sold in your community if you keep people from doing dumb things. You keep people out of the deepest parts of the floodplain and you control it. Some communities have bought into that, 20,000 have. Others have not, and there are other places where there's almost no land use control, and they allow people to move in and build developments. We've seen this in California where somebody will build 500 homes, and the community will allow that to happen with a very makeshift levy, and then all of a sudden the levy fails and everybody's flooded, and you and I as taxpayers pick up the tab. So we need to have some emphasis on land use planning, as you say, but not from the feds, as you suggest. It ought to be from the people who really know what's going on in their community. There's got to be some coordination among states by the federal government, certainly, better one-on-one state to state. But it's a difficult thing to do. I can tell you that nobody likes to tell their neighbor they can't build here or there. Yet, you're right, if they build there and there's a disaster, everybody is part of bailing them out. The other part of that, I would argue, that if they decide that they're going to let people be in the floodplain, then we really ought to find a way to enforce the flood insurance. They're telling us that maybe 10% of the people who were flooded in Iowa had flood insurance. That's not very good. I mean, when you we recommended in a very harsh move, draconian as you call it, after the 93 flood, that if you could have bought insurance and didn't, and you have a flood, then the federal government's going to get you off your roof, but they're not going to give you any more flood assistance. That's kind of harsh to do, but you got to ask, why would you do something for a neighbor whose house burned down and he just said, I'm never going to buy fire insurance?
I know, and move back into that same house after reconstruct it and have those same risks present and not be willing to take insurance to spread the cost of that.
Right.
Our insurance is a great risk management tool, so... Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let me again introduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Gerald Galloway. He's professor of engineering in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland at College Park, where he's also affiliate professor in the School of Public Policy. His focus is on water resources policy and management. He is also a visiting scholar at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Institute for Water Resources, has a lot of experience with water management issues in the U.S. and around the world. He served as a consultant to the Executive Office of the President, also the World Bank, Organization of American States, the TVA, the Corps of Engineers, governments of several states, and among the many things he did, one thing I just want to mention again was that he was assigned to the White House to lead the Interagency Floodplain Management Review Committee in assessing the causes of the 1993 floods on the Mississippi and proposing a long-term approach to floodplain management. And we're talking about the flooding that we just had earlier this spring in June here in the Midwest. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. Maybe I should have mentioned that you were with the Corps. You're a former military man. We're with the Corps. And it does not surprise me that we would have at least one caller who would maybe have something to say about the Corps. I think that some people feel that that the Corps in its activities in our watershed and other places have actually somehow made things worse and not made things better.
Well, very clearly, the Corps of Engineers is looked on as the nation's engineer. It's unfortunate that whenever there is a disaster like this and people are fighting to keep their levees intact, the Corps of Engineers is authorized to go out and help them do it. And when it overtops, people say, well, it was the Corps' idea. They should have done something about it. That couldn't be farther from the truth. The Corps has done its best to try and get people to do the right thing, but it's very difficult when, A, there are local decisions, and, two, the decisions the Corps executes are not made by them but are made by, in reality, the local governments, the governors, and the Congress in deciding where things should go. That's not to say the Corps hasn't made mistakes. We're dealing with engineering. We're dealing with a rapidly changing world with more rain. It's awful hard to keep up with Mother Nature when we see the changes in the rainfall. But I would argue that the Corps of the federal government is really trying to help, and they are trying to be responsive. It's not always easy to find out who is representing the real local interest, and I think that's one of the challenges that everybody that lives near a river faces.
All right, let's talk with someone here in Oakwood, line number one.
Yes. Yep. Ironically, my name also is Gerald, but I'm a bit humbled to whom I'm speaking with.
Oh, no, sir.
Let me be brief. I just feel that we're using archaic methods, sandbags and so forth and so on. I've had a personal issue with all of this rain. I've had a lot of erosion. And I found using these flexible pipes, 2, 4, 6, 8 inches in diameter, which would divert the water. And as it was full, it would also control the level of the water, if I'm explaining myself correctly.
Yes, sir.
Does that make any sense to you?
Well, there are
actually... It certainly worked for me. We had as many as 5 inches at a time down here, and I had to divert the water so it would not go into my basement. And by doing that, it also added height to the level, and it retained the water.
Well, as I mentioned at the start, the first recorded work we saw is in New Orleans. Actually, there's some at the same time on the East Coast where the people were building levees. And the techniques, while we have better methods of testing, the techniques aren't much different. And there really there are a lot of people around the world, because I've spent a lot of time in Holland lately, who are looking for the solution. And there are actually people looking at something like you're talking about on a larger scale, where having a pipe and filling it with water to keep it down instead of having to pile up dirt is an idea. Any number of these schemes were tested on this particular flood. Some work, some not so well.
So there is a concept there, huh?
Yes. I mean, there's clearly a concept. The idea is if you want to keep the water out, how do you do it quickly if it's an unusual circumstances? There are things called mud boxes made out of plywood you fill with earth that try and keeps them, keep them the boxes from being pushed out of the way. The problem is, and the sad part for many communities, is even sandbags and special tools do two things. They put additional weight on the levee and could actually cause it to fail because you're putting so much more weight on it than it was designed for. And two, water is insidious. It can find its way through any crack, as we all know.
I understand.
But I think your idea is one that on a larger scale is being looked at. I know people are trying to, in the reconstruction of New Orleans, looking for, if they go to the next step, what could they do to make 21st century levees instead of going after just earthen levees?
Well, I think that's something that would be flexible, that could be shrunk down so that a truck could carry it and then expand kind of like one of these flexi things that, these things that go up and down the stairs, I should say.
Yes.
Down the stairs.
Slinkies.
There you go. I'm kind of stuttering here. But as I was seeing this take place, I'm thinking of those poor people along the river, and I'm saying to myself, well, if it works here, why would it not work on a grander scale?
Well, you'd be, I think, happy to know that in many places where the water, people thought the levee was going to overtop, but people took individual homes and had various methods of protecting them, from sandbags to devices like yours, where they took whatever they could that would form a barrier and protect the house itself. While they were sort of an island in the middle of a flooded area, they were still dry.
I understand. One other question. The sandbags, all of this effort to install them, are they then having to be taken down?
Yes, sir. That's one of the interesting challenges. I met somebody in another state where they just had big flooding, and she said, look at the wonderful beach I have on this river now. Because she agreed to take the sandbags and take the sand out and dump it on this area to form a beach, and then she disposed of the sandbags themselves. But it's not a simple problem, as you can imagine. They're heavy, they're wet, and sometimes dirty.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go next and talk with somebody in Ford County. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could speak about something that I heard, that the plastic sandbags tend to slip over each other, whereas the old-time burlap did not.
Yeah, I've heard that same thing. I don't have any definitive evidence that's available to me right now to see what came out of this particular round. But as you know, for every new solution, we find a new problem with
it.
And there are lots of problems with the sandbags, including the disposal, as we just talked about, and how do you keep them together? And are you putting them up in a rainy situation or a dry situation? Are they carefully packed? How wide is the sandbagging? So you put your finger on something. I would not want to say that plastic is not as good as or not as good as the ones we had, the burlap sandbags. But in some cases, obviously, it does create different challenges for you.
I never knew the problem was that big. You just gave me five other things to think about.
Yeah. Thanks.
All right. Thank
yes,
you.
Sir.
Other questions are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Gerald Galloway. He's professor of engineering at University of Maryland, College Park, and his interest is water resources policy and management. We're talking about the floods of June here in the Midwest. And you want to call in, have a question, have a comment, that's fine. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We said a little earlier, talked about the fact that certainly you would encourage people who live in the floodplain, if they're living in a flood-prone area, that they should have insurance, and in fact that there is in Congress this move to require people who live in these areas to have insurance. What about, I imagine that there are some places where it might actually make sense to make the argument to someone like that that they should actually just move. And certainly after 93, we saw entire towns make the decision to move.
Well, are there some, you know, Valmeyer in your state was certainly right. One... Mayor Knobloch, certainly, you had a dynamo for a mayor there who was able to muster the resources. That's the success story out of the post-93 events, is the fact that prior to 1993, the idea of moving neighborhoods or entire towns was something no one would have considered. But the success that's been shown, I just a few minutes ago spoke to somebody who just came back from Cedar Rapids, and he was talking to people who say, get me FEMA. I want to move out of here. I mean, you can only take so much of it. They had 93 high water, and now they've got this water. It makes sense. You pay the cost of moving them, but that's the last time you're going to pay flood damages. Mm-hmm. So it does make sense. And the first recommendation we had in our report was, when you're in an area that's subject to inundation, the first answer would be, if you're really hit a lot, probably move. And if you're considering you're coming from another area, moving, don't move in an area that's in the floodplain. Avoid the floodplain, except for those things like ports, harbors, recreation areas that the floodplain is useful for. And agriculture. There's nothing wrong with agriculture being in the floodplain.
So you would support the idea of trying to provide some assistance to people in the floodplain if their decision was to relocate entirely?
Yes, and that's been a very useful tool. In the Grand Forks case in North Dakota, in East Grand Forks, where they had this major flooding, they determined that they didn't have enough room for the river to get through the city, and that every time they had the flood, they were going to have a problem. So they relocated, I think, close to 300 homes. They either relocated or bought out people. And I think the figure now, I would guess, is around a nationwide 30,000 voluntary relocations as a result of flooding since 1993.
Let's talk with some other folks. We have several callers standing by. Next, we'll go to Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hi. My question actually relates to the relocation. I was wondering if people have done any studies of people who actually live in the floodplain areas and ask questions like, you know, what's your salary, what's your average income, what's the cost of your house, and why do you live there, you know, why did you first move here, did you know about the floodplain? But because I see the people that live in the floodplains as being completely different than the type of people that go to California and put their houses up in the mountains, in among the trees that where there's you know, fires that come through every year, because those are completely different people that do those types of things, where they keep moving back into the same place that's going to be destroyed in a couple of years. And I was just wondering if there has been like a sociological study or a kind of just, you know, even finances of why people actually move back into the floodplains or move to live in the floodplains to start with.
You've got your finger on something. There have been studies. Matter of fact, a large group of people meet every year in Boulder, Colorado at the Natural Hazard Center, and that's one of the key topics every year, is what causes people to do what they're doing to react to a natural hazard, especially floods. In the riverine areas, in many cases, when outside of the urban areas, when you get to a city like Sacramento or St. Louis or Kansas City, people and businesses that locate there have a different structure. But by and large, though, on riverine areas, they tend to be people who have less opportunity to go to other places. The exception to that's the river rat, somebody that wants to look out and see the water and be close to it, fishes, hunts, that sort of thing. The difference is, and you're right when you think of California and people who live in the woods, think of our coastline. Along the East Coast here, there's hardly a home that's directly on the beach that's not at least $1 million. So you have the opposite, whereas you have relatively low income, comparatively low income, in many of the riverine areas outside of urban areas because the property is cheaper and there are some benefits to that. In areas where it's a high amenity, like the coast and in the woods, in the case of fire, the incomes are much higher. And that's a challenge because what does that mean in the riverine areas is that the people who are there have less income, and therefore the impact of having to buy flood insurance is much higher. The impact on somebody who has a $1 million home on the beach paying a high insurance premium is not anywhere as proportionate to what it is for somebody who lives along a river. And that's one of the challenges. How do we provide a safety net for people who are already there? The other problem is when you get to a big city and there are 50,000 or 100,000 people behind the levee, they come in all sorts of economic strata and economic and social background, and they just happen to find a place to live there, and they've always thought that was safe.
Thanks.
All right. Very good. Let's talk next with someone in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. So actually, I was wondering, it seems like a lot of perspective on floods and things of that sort is like an engineering problem, whereas it seems like a greater respect for nature, more floodplains, not damming up rivers to protect the mangrove forests and so on, would be a much more effective way of proceeding. But I'll leave it at that question.
Well, that's a great question. Yeah. And it's what's interesting is where you all are sitting in the Midwest, just think back to the end, 1850, 1849, the Swamplands Acts, where the federal government was, in effect, subsidizing the states to drain the wetlands, to take the swamps and convert them to, quote, useful, unquote, purposes. We've come a long way since 1850, and we've recognized the natural and beneficial functions of the floodplain. And I think that's what is changing the way we look at flood damage reduction. In the middle of the 60s, a man named Gilbert White, who was at the University of Chicago, wrote a paper. He'd actually written it before it was his dissertation, to talk about human adjustment to the floodplain. In other words, you've got to share with nature. You've got to give nature room to run. Floods are natural. The flood damages are not. And it's just exactly what you said, is we've got to protect this. Probably one of our richest environments is the riverine environment. So everything that I see the federal government doing now is focused on, yes, let's not leave people at risk, but let's find a way, if we're going to provide them any sort of protection or risk reduction, we're going to also incorporate that doing something about the natural ecosystems. And that comes across big time in the restoration in New Orleans, because probably more of the money that goes into that eventually will go into coastal wetland restoration.
All right. Well, again, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Well, I have one more I want to try to get in Champaign. This is line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. What about muskrats? We quit trapping fur bearing animals, and the muskrats have just gone wild. What kind of effect have they had on the dikes?
Well, that's you raise an interesting question. I wish I could give you a good answer. That's a worry right now. We know that the construction or the integrity, the strength of a levee and a dike is a function of, are there trees in it? Are there animals rooting in there? Who's taking care of it? Is it sloughing? And animals can be a part of that. And a part of this assessment that we're talking about having, and having the federal government go out and look at these levees, having the local communities look at them is to see, is there this sort of muskrat infestation? Or who's digging holes in that particular levee? Because the worst thing in the world you want is have any sort of a hole through there that water can find, and then it becomes the pipeline to carry the levee away. So you're absolutely right. When I was living in Mississippi, we worried about that very issue. Beaver, how do you control that? What do you do about it? When you control the population, there are other ramifications. So you put your finger on something that we need to look at.
Well, like a muskrat can dig from one side of a dike to another, and you know, that just opens up the hole.
Exactly. What that tells you is, if I live behind one of those levees, I want to know that my levee district was out there checking to see, and when they found it, they were going to do something about it. Because unfortunately, sometimes we don't find out about it until the water's coming through.
We're going to finish up here just to round us out. You know, we know that regardless of setting aside the argument about what the cause is, that we seem to be pretty sure that we're in a period here where for some time we're going to be expecting some of these heavy rain events that we've seen. And certainly we know that we've had now three very serious floods within the last 15 years. Now, the question is, what are we going to do at this point to try to better prepare for what we should expect to be future events like this?
My fundamental approach is you have to use all the tools available to you. There is no one silver bullet that's going to solve the problem. Levees are only one part of the answer. It's got to be flood insurance. It's got to be proper land use. It's got to be evacuation planning. It's got to be elevation in the homes, raising them in some areas, flood proofing. You have to look at all of these sorts of things. And it's not just the federal government's responsibility. The individual landowner, the county, and the state have to become involved in this.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Gerald Galloway. He's professor of engineering at the University of Maryland College Park, where he's also affiliate professor in the School of Public Policy. He's a visiting scholar at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Institute for Water Resources and has spent a lot of time on these particular issues, water resources policy and management. And Dr. Galloway, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.